Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Endocrinology. This podcast aims to look at the key considerations for addressing cardiorenal outcomes in patients with CKD and T2D. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an educational grant from Bayer. In this first section, Professor Peter Rossing and Dr. Eden Miller respond to questions and provide their expert insights on the epidemiological and pathophysiological drivers for the progression of CKD.
My name is Dr. Eden Miller. I'm a family practitioner at Diabetes and Obesity Care Medical Group in Oregon, USA. I'm joined today by my esteemed colleague, Professor Peter Rossing, who is the head of complications research at Steno Diabetes Center, Copenhagen, in Herlev, Denmark. Together, we will have a conversation around cardiorenal outcomes in CKD and type 2 diabetes. What are the key considerations for daily practice? Following an overview of the association between type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease and the underlying pathophysiology, we'll explore the current available therapies with evidence for reducing cardiorenal outcomes. Finally, we'll take a look at the current guidelines and discuss how we can apply them in our daily practice. We're going to start by discussing the link between type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease. And what are the pathophysiologic drivers behind the progression of CKD? The epidemiology of CKD and type 2 diabetes is vast. It is estimated that 40% of patients with type 2 diabetes will develop chronic kidney disease in their lifetime. Type 2 diabetes with chronic kidney disease can shorten the life expectancy of patients by 16 years relative to those who don't have either of those diseases. In many cases, that could be missing the birth and growth of grandchildren. Patients with chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes are also at a 2-time increased risk for developing heart failure, and 3 times more likely to die of cardiovascular-related causes rather than those patients who don't just have type 2 diabetes alone. In addition, diabetes exacerbates the progression of chronic kidney disease. Each stage of your renal, from stage 3 to stage 4 and to stage 5, we have a median time in chronic kidney disease that accelerates as the diabetes has poor control. So this damage, this progression of chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes is like a freight train that just accelerates as we get older and longer into the disease progression. There's a high association between the complications of type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease, and cardiovascular disease. We call it that overlap. We know type 2 diabetes has neuropathy. We have this formation of glycation end products, as well as the hyperglycemia. We have associated dysmetabolism with dyslipidemia, hypercoagulability, all the inflammatory things about the endothelium, the oxidative stress, and hypertension. But when we look at chronic kidney disease, there's this overlap. We see that the two disease states share many of those dysfunctions. While chronic kidney disease has anemia and calcium and phosphate metabolism issues, as well as hormone imbalance and that overactivity of the RAS system, that uremic toxins and what we call that volume overload, that preload and afterload to the kidney, but there is quite a bit of overlap of the pathology with that dysmetabolic and inflammatory, as well as that endothelial dysfunction that is shared between those two organs. And that's the major mechanism of the association between cardiovascular disease and chronic kidney disease. Now, if we look at the pathophysiologic drivers of chronic kidney disease and its progression, we start to see that type 2 diabetes from the epigenetic or environmental factors influences, those stressors, those drivers by lifestyle and behavior, coupled with the genetic factors that those individuals possess. We see the hyperglycemic and increased RAS state creates this cascade of metabolic through poor glycemic control, hemodynamic through elevated blood pressure and volume-related intraglomerular pressure issues, which leads to inflammation and ultimately fibrosis, which is the body's attempt to try and repair all of this damage. Because of that intercellular signaling and all those different transcription factors that the cell is shoving out all these additional instructions, we see the glomerulus respond by trying to hypertrophy. We see mesangial expansion, those tubulointerstitial fibrosis and inflammation, which results in glomerulosclerosis and kidney fibrosis. And all of this circular process causes the progression of CKD to occur in a lifetime with type 2 diabetes. So to begin, Professor Rossin, let's take a look at some of the questions that have been submitted by our audience on the link between chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes, as well as the drivers of CKD progression. My first question, what are the key laboratory parameters that indicate CKD progression? How and when should we start monitoring for these, and how often?
Very important question, because kidney disease doesn't give symptoms until the very late stages. So we need to do regular screening for kidney disease. And what we are doing is we measure albuminuria and we measure eGFR, estimated kidney function. And you could consider albuminuria as a marker of kidney damage and eGFR, kidney function. And we need these two parameters in order to evaluate the stage of kidney disease. And unfortunately, many places are not measuring albuminuria, but it is a very important risk marker for cardiovascular disease, for progression of kidney disease risk, and for mortality risk. So we need to capture both albuminuria and eGFR. And we should measure it every year from onset of or from diagnosis of type 2 diabetes.
That's an excellent take-home message, making sure to get those two metrics at least every year. So an additional question. I think it would be helpful if clinicians could stratify the risk of CKD progression and adverse cardiorenal outcomes. Are there any tools that I can use in my daily practice to accomplish this?
Yeah, KDIGO developed a heat map, which is quite simple, actually. You put albuminuria going up in columns, so from normal to moderately increased to severely increased. That indicates the kidney damage, as I mentioned. And then you have rows for declining kidney function and or eGFR. And then you have, if you are in the upper left corner, you'll have normal kidney function, normal albuminuria. That means you are good, you have a low risk. But if you have increasing albuminuria or decreasing kidney function, that means your risk goes up. That's the risk for kidney disease progression, cardiovascular events, and mortality. So we need to monitor both to capture the whole risk and to be able to stratify people into this heat map from normal to very high risk for kidney disease progression.
That's an excellent tool. I could see that being used in daily practice to create a conversation between the prescriber and the patient where both of them can have value from that and understanding. Now, I have a case for you. A 60-year-old male patient who was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes about 10 years ago. He's recently been diagnosed with CKD with progressive albuminuria of 50 milligrams per gram, and he's got an eGFR right around 49 milliliters per minute. What are his risks for further progression, and should I refer him to a nephrologist?
Yeah, that's a good and quite typical case. Moderately increased albuminuria signifies that he is at increased risk for progression of kidney disease as well as for cardiovascular events. And the moderately increased kidney function, where you could say below 60, that is, designates you have chronic kidney disease. And in this range around 50, you are in the moderately decreased range, also signifying an increased risk for progression of kidney disease as well as an increased risk for cardiovascular events. So with these two parameters being abnormal, with the increase in albuminuria and the decrease in kidney function, he's certainly at risk and in need for some of the new treatment opportunities we can offer. I wouldn't send him to a nephrologist yet, but it depends on local agreements when to refer to a nephrologist. In our setting, it's either if you have a very fast decline in kidney function or when you reach a GFR of around 30 milliliters per minute. So, Probably he can be managed with a GP or with a GP in collaboration with an endocrinologist, or you can have a nephrologist giving advice on how to manage a patient like this. But as I said, it depends a bit on your local agreements. In our setting, it would be the endocrinologist and the general practitioner in collaboration that will deal with a patient like this.
So this has been lovely discussing the epidemiology and the pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes in discussion related to chronic kidney disease as well as cardiovascular disease. Thank you so much, Dr. Rossin, for providing that commentary on this wonderful subject, giving us that better insight on how to identify and address those concerns with our persons with type 2 diabetes.
In this second section, Professor Peter Rossing and Dr. Eden Miller respond to questions and provide their expert insights on the cardiorenal risks associated with CKD and T2D and how they can be addressed.
Let's have a conversation. What are the cardiorenal risks associated with CKD and type 2 diabetes, and how can they be addressed? Cardiorenal outcomes in type 2 diabetes and CKD are definitely a hand-in-glove type of association. I've often said that the kidney is queen, but the heart is king. They are so intimately related. And we see as the progressive EGFR declines, we see this handoff of increased cardiorenal mortality. We know in the cardiovascular realm, we have heart failure as a very high occurrence amongst persons with type 2 diabetes, as well as myocardial infarction, peripheral artery disease, stroke, and cardiovascular death. But this is also associated concomitantly in the kidney arena with albuminuria, end-stage kidney disease, renal replacement therapy, as well as renal death. Oftentimes, the question is, which comes first? Cardiovascular disease or kidney disease, or are they there simultaneously experiencing the ravages and damages of type 2 diabetes? Now let's have a discussion around the approved therapies that have evidence for reducing that cardiorenal outcomes in those persons with chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes. Many of you are quite familiar that the SGLT2 as a class all seem to possess a similar type of benefit. From the 3-point MACE composition reduction, as well as the addition of reduction of hospitalizations for heart failure. If we look at the key components regarding kidney, we also see a decrease in the risk of progression of renal decline in the EGFR amongst all the different individual SGLT2 inhibitors in the class. In addition, we're waiting for the EMPA kidney data to be revealed. That should be relatively soon. And then we finally see that ertugliflozin also has that reduction in cardiovascular death and heart failure, as well as that reduction in the decline in renal failure. If we transition to the non-steroidal MRAs, finerenone, this is a non-glucose-lowering agent, but rather a blockade of that mineral corticoid receptor that causes fibrosis and damage of the glomerular membrane. Those trials showed that there was a reduction in actual 4-point MACE in that therapy, as well as a reduction in kidney death, the sustaining of the GFR, the reduction in decline of the GFR, as well as micro and macro albuminuria. And then finally, don't forget, GLP-1 receptor agonists, dulaglutide, liraglutide, and semaglutide also have shown reduction in MACE events depending on different populations, but there are also new data emerging regarding the reduction of macroalbuminuria as well as the sustaining of the EGFR. Now, there were highlights from EASD and ESC 2022. The CANVAS and CREDENCE data were looked at from a new perspective. EMPA-REG had an additional data analysis with a 30% lower odds of worsening or greater than 50% higher odds of improvement in the KDIGO CKD risk factors. There were additional highlights as well surrounding the FIDELITY trial, the effects of finerenone on composite CV and kidney outcomes not modified by hip-to-weight ratio, We know that there are benefits of finerenone on composite CV and kidney outcomes, but it was consistent in irrespective GLP-1 receptor agonists used at baseline, with greater efficacy on UACR reduction when GLP-1s were used concomitantly. Now, REWIND was looked at, dulaglutide associated with an additional 9% reduction of atherosclerosis in patients with type 2 diabetes, CVD, and high CV risk, and SUSTAIN-6 and PIONEER-6 were also reviewing both the oral and injectable forms of semaglutide on MACE across varying baseline A1Cs as well as EGFR and UACR subgroups. Professor Rossi, let's take a look at some of the questions submitted by our audience on how to address the cardiorenal risks associated with CKD and type 2 diabetes. Question 1. Recent data from the key trials like CANVAS or DAPA-CKD, as well as DECLARE and EMPA-REG and CREDENCE, have shown that SGLT2 inhibitors reduce the risk of CV events and delay the progression of CKD. Are there any differences in these trials evaluating the various SGLT2 inhibitors? And with these data in mind, how do I choose the right one for my patients?
Yeah, that's a good question. And let's start with the difference between these trials. EMPA-REG, CANVAS, and then DECLARE, they were cardiovascular outcome trials in populations with, in EMPA-REG, very high cardiovascular risk. Everybody had a previous cardiovascular event. CANVAS was a mix of people with previous event or high risk, and in DECLARE it was even more patients with risk but not with a previous event. And what was seen in these trials was that, as you also mentioned, that MACE was reduced and also that heart failure hospitalization was reduced. So that was a benefit in a high cardiovascular risk population but with relatively low kidney risk, although all these studies also suggested a kidney benefit. Then CREDENCE was the first outcome trial in a population with type 2 diabetes and kidney disease, where people had albuminuria and a wide range of GFR from 30 to 90. And in this population, there was a kidney progression benefit and reduction also in cardiovascular events. So now we're talking about a kidney population. And DAPA-CKD expanded this further to a population with wider range of albuminuria and lower GFR, but also including non-diabetic kidney disease, showing that the benefit we see in diabetic kidney disease is similar in non-diabetic kidney disease. Again, stressing the point you mentioned that it's not about lowering glucose, this is about organ protection. And you can say, although there are differences in some of these studies looking at the endpoints, overall, it's very consistent findings across these trials on cardiovascular and kidney benefit.
So I have another question. What is the evidence of using non-steroidal MRAs to reduce cardiorenal risk, and how do they contribute to the treatment pathway for patients with CKD and type 2 diabetes? Which patients are they effective for, and are there any safety concerns that we should have?
Well, that's a more recent class. As you mentioned, we've had the SGLT2 inhibitors for many years, but just recently, the non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist finerenone was approved for use. That was based on two trials, FIGARO and FIDELIO, which was done in type 2 diabetes patients with kidney disease and a wide range of albuminuria and GFR from slightly elevated above 30 milligrams per gram of albuminuria and up to 5,000, and from GFR from 25 and up. And in this population, it was seen, as you also mentioned, less progression of kidney disease and less cardiovascular event, particularly less heart failure. And the non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist showed this benefit on top of usual RAS blockade, which is standard of care in all patients. And then actually there were subgroups treated with GLP-1 receptor agonist or SGLT2 inhibitors, suggesting that benefits may be actually synergistic or additive. And then when you ask about side effects, the main concern for the non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist was whether they could prove to be beneficial without increasing hyperkalemia risk. And potassium has to be measured, and there was an increase in potassium, but it was actually much less than seen with the previous old steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists. So potassium is much less of an issue, and only less than 2% of the participants in these trials, Figaro and Fidelio, had to stop taking study drug because of hyperkalemia. So side effects, for instance, like gynecomastia or breast hyperplasia, which are seen with also with the old steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, were not seen at all. Hypotension is not a problem. So overall, a very easy to use drug, but with this notion that you need to keep an eye on potassium. And you were not allowed to go into the trials if you had a potassium level above 4.8.
So I have another patient. She's a 63-year-old female who developed type 2 diabetes when she was about 30 years of age, and she's now been diagnosed with progressive CKD. So about 4 years ago, her eGFR was 40 milliliters per minute, and her UACR was around 360 milligrams per gram. Recently, her eGFR has declined to 30 mLs per minute, and her UACR now has gone up to 1,200 milligrams per gram. She's got a BMI of around 31 kilograms, and her A1C is at 7.2, and she's currently taking lisinopril, amlodipine, atorvastatin, metformin, and glimepiride. What are the best therapeutic options I can choose from to help slow this progression of her CKD?
Yeah, that's also a good question, and certainly a patient who's progressive, so we need to do something or all the best we can do for such a patient. And she is on an ACE inhibitor, so she's on a RAS inhibitor, which is recommended as, you could say, the foundational therapy of kidney disease and diabetes. But then on top of that, we will add an SGLT2 inhibitor, because that has also now been recommended as therapy based on the trials we discussed before, CREDENCE, DAPA-CKD, and potentially also the upcoming EMPA-KIDNEY trial and the data from the cardiovascular outcome trials. So an SGLT2 inhibitor should be added. At this level of kidney function, there will not be any effect on glucose, but there will still be a benefit for the kidney as well as for the heart. And then she might also be a candidate, given that there is this serious progression, for adding, if she still have albuminuria after adding the SGLT2 inhibitor, that you could add the non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, finerenone. And finerenone would be great, and you can use it if her GFR stays above 25, even after she had started the SGLT2 inhibitor. And the combination together is actually also beneficial from the point of view that it reduces the risk of hyperkalemia. Along the way, and to control glucose, probably we may need to stop metformin soon when she gets below 30 in kidney function, or if she gets below 30 in kidney function. And then it's worth considering that the GLP-1 receptor agonist that you also mentioned, both have cardiovascular protection in this population and also have kidney protective benefits, although a dedicated kidney trial is ongoing and we are waiting for the results. I wouldn't start all these three therapies in one day, and maybe not needed, but I'll start with the SGLT2 inhibitor and follow quickly with the mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist.
So question number four, the treatment landscape for CKD and type 2 diabetes has rapidly changed over the last 5 years. With the approval of SGLT2 inhibitors and non-steroidal MRAs, however, are there any long-term data on these therapies in this disease, and can I be sure about their safety?
Yeah, if we start with the SGLT2 inhibitors, they have been around for more than 10 years available to treat patients. Initially, there was actually concern if they would damage the kidney because you increase glucosuria. And then we learned from the cardiovascular outcome trials that you reviewed that they're actually kidney friendly and kidney protective. So we have known them for a long time. Blocking, on the other hand, aldosterone activation of the mineralocorticoid receptor, well, finerenone has not been on the market for a long time, but we have the large clinical trials, and Figaro and Fidelio were actually the largest trial program in kidney disease with more than 13,000 participants. So we really have good data from these trials with a mean duration of 3 years follow-up that this is safe and kidney and cardiovascular beneficial. We don't have 20 years of follow-up with these data, but I don't think we need that with the current evidence and all these patient years of observation in these large trials.
So, Professor Rossin, thank you so much for such an excellent conversation exploring those cardiovascular and chronic kidney disease outcomes in those therapies and giving us some insight and direction of where to go with them. Much appreciated. And I feel that we've done a great dive into how to be very purposeful with prescribing with type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and chronic kidney disease in mind.
In this final section, Professor Peter Rossing and Dr. Eden Miller respond to questions and provide their expert insights on the latest clinical guidelines for treating CKD and T2D and how they can be applied in daily practice.
Let's discuss the latest clinical guidelines for the management of chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes. There are three basic entities that provide guidelines for when to screen, what type of screening, as well as treatment for those persons with type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease. The ADA and the EASD, as well as KDIGO, have various guidelines that are in some cases similar and others a little bit differently. It's universally recommended that all persons with type 2 diabetes annually get a screen. So if there's one thing I can reinforce is that every year, make sure that those patients are getting that estimated eGFR as well as the UACR together. We need both of those in order to effectively screen. Now, the diagnosis for kidney disease generally occurs at around an eGFR of less than 60, or if a UACR is greater than 30 milligrams per gram. In addition, there are first-line treatment recommendations that are fairly consistent amongst the three entities, with the SGLT2 addition beyond metformin when the GFR is greater than or equal to about 25 or higher. In addition, other recommendations are starting to emerge. The ADA has recommended as an alternative the non-steroidal mRNAs for those who could not tolerate an SGLT2 or increased risk of cardiovascular and CKD progression and events, or what we call that residual microalbuminuria. The EASD also has placed GLP-1 receptor agonists for those if the GFR is greater than 30, and so has KDIGO as recommended and endorsed the GLP-1 effects of kidney and cardiovascular. So, Professor Rossin, let's look at some questions that have been submitted by audience on how best to implement the clinical guidelines in daily practice. Question number one. I'm a primary care physician treating several individuals who have CKD and type 2 diabetes. For my patients unable to use SGLT2 inhibitors, it's not quite clear from the guidelines what I should do next. Which guidelines should I follow, and how can I stay up to date with changes in these guidelines?
That's a fantastic question. As you mentioned, there are three different guidelines, but we are also living in an environment where there's new data generated all the time and guidelines are being updated. So it is a bit of a challenge to keep up. Many of these guidelines that you mentioned, they're actually before the mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists were recommended for kidney disease, and we had the data from Figaro and Fidelio. But the ADA is updated this year and includes recommendations for non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists in patients on RAS blockade with an ACE inhibitor or an angiotensin II receptor blocker, either on an SGLT2 inhibitor that do not tolerate an SGLT2 inhibitor, and where there is still albuminuria and therefore need for further treatment. And KDIGO guideline that you mentioned is from 2020. It's being updated here this year and will now also include recommendations for non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, as you said. And the ESC and EASD guideline will be updated next year. So there we'll also see the inclusion of the non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptors. So finerenone is certainly an option for a patient like the one you have, where SGLT2 inhibitor is not tolerated, where there is standard of care therapy and you need more to stop progression of kidney disease. You just need to ensure that potassium is less than 4.8 and then you can start finerenone.
So the next question is, how are the different stages of CKD defined, and what do the guidelines say about which treatment is suitable for each particular stage?
Yeah, as you said, there are different stages based on different degrees of albuminuria and also declining kidney function. And with increasing albuminuria, if that's above normal, as you said, above 30, then blockade of the renin-angiotensin system is recommended, and you can also use finerenone. Whereas if kidney function declines below 60 and you have albuminuria, then also SGLT2 inhibitors were recommended. But in the newest guidelines, they will actually say that either if you have increased albuminuria or if you have a GFR less than 60 but above 20, then you can use an SGLT2 inhibitor to protect the kidney. And finerenone covers the spectrum from above 30 in albuminuria and up to 5,000. And you can give it to any person with a GFR above 25. And then it's important to remember that if you start an SGLT2 inhibitor or a finerenone, a non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, then you can continue treatment until you reach dialysis. Because in the trials, people didn't stop when they reached, for instance, 20 or 25 in GFR. They continued until kidney failure.
Sounds like we have lots of different options depending on the different stages in the progression of the kidney disease. Thanks so much. So another question, what do the guidelines say about the contraindications for the different therapies available to patients? I'm particularly concerned about my elderly patients or those with a history of hyperkalemia or diabetic ketoacidosis, as well as my patients with hepatic impairment. What treatments are available for them?
Well, we should also be or always be considerate about the, let's say, frail patients, the elderly patients. And there was concern about dehydration and volume depletion with SGLT2 inhibitors in the elderly. But actually, it seems that acute kidney injury, which could be the extreme case of dehydration, is reduced with SGLT2 inhibitors. But I will still be cautious in frail elderly with frequent urinary tract infections or with a risk for dehydration, particularly in very hot areas. Whereas for the mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, it's about potassium, where potassium that's elevated should be a concern. For liver problems you mentioned, actually these drugs can be used unless you have severe liver failure, where there is not much experience with either SGLT2 inhibitors or finerenone, but on the other hand, also no indications of an increased risk. And in relation to GFR, kidney disease, then it would follow that with a decline in kidney function, the glucose-lowering effect of the SGLT2 inhibitors are decreasing, but it keeps its kidney and cardiovascular protective benefit even in the very low range of kidney function. For the SGLT2 inhibitors, there has been concern about diabetic ketoacidosis because it's more increased or frequent in the clinical trials. It's still a very rare event in type 2 diabetes. So even with the SGLT2 inhibitors, this is occurring very, very rarely. And where should you be careful? That's in the very lean people. Don't stop insulin if people are treated with insulin. When you give an SGLT2 inhibitor, that could increase the risk for ketoacidosis. But as I said, that's really a rare event.
Do the guidelines provide any advice on how to best manage the common side effects of these different therapies for CKD and type 2 diabetes, such as dehydration or hyperkalemia or genital infections or those gastrointestinal effects?
Yeah, in relation to the SGLT2 inhibitors, there are recommendations for making sure you have daily washing or cleaning, that you have don't treat people with very frequent previous history of urinary tract infections or genital infections. But for most patients, it's more about giving the information that this is a risk and that it can easily be avoided and treated. For the potassium problems with the finerenone compound, it's about considering diet, considering if you have any medications that increase the risk of hyperkalemia, And then it could be to mitigate a risk for increasing in potassium, could be to increase doses of diuretics, or it could be modifications of diet, which is usually not necessary. And if we are treating with the GLP-1 receptor agonist, which are recommended particularly for the cardiovascular benefit, also in these patients with kidney disease, but potentially also for the kidney protection, then the gastrointestinal side effects with nausea is an issue, particularly with low kidney function. But here the advice is start slow in low doses and uptitrate slowly, and advise people to take small, frequent meals rather than large meals, because that increases the risk for nausea.
Absolutely. In my clinical practice in primary care, I do a lot of education surrounding barrier creams for the SGLT2s to prevent that irritation with the glucosuria effect on the perineum. And I do something similar with the GI-related effects of GLP-1s. I tell the patients, you're going to feel full faster. Stop immediately eating when you feel full, as to not have that additional satiety.
Yeah, and I think actually to that point, it's also about managing expectations and explain that this is actually not a side effect, but it's a way of action of the drugs.
Absolutely. Final question for you, Professor Racine. What do the different guidelines recommend around self-management of the disease, including dietary and lifestyle changes for those living with CKD and type 2 diabetes? What strategies do you use to educate your patients?
Well, that's an important question, because as for any person with type 2 diabetes, management of lifestyle, physical activity, diet, not smoke, and is really important, and is the foundation, you could say, that the medication therapy is built upon. So we need to look at physical activity, where the recommendations are as for any person with type 2 diabetes, but where we need to pay attention to those with kidney disease tend to be less physically active. So they may need an extra attention on this topic. And in relation to the diet, it's important that the recommendation is a healthy diet, as for any person with type 2 diabetes, lots of fruits, vegetables, not too much meat, and not too much salt or sodium chloride in the diet. With very low kidney function, there's a need to pay attention to potassium and phosphate in the diet, and it may be helpful to have the expertise of a dietitian that both knows about diet for diabetes and diet for kidney disease to help guiding potassium and sodium intake in these patients. And we aim for a protein intake of 0.8 gram per kilo body weight, which is also as for any person without diabetes, but is probably a little bit less than many of us are eating today, where many are having too much meat and thereby a high protein intake. So that's also a point to pay attention to.
Thank you so much, Professor Rossi. And this has been a lovely discussion reviewing the guidelines and interventional of lifestyle and different therapies for the management of chronic kidney disease, type 2 diabetes, and cardiovascular risk reduction.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic on Touch Endocrinology at www.touchendocrinology.com.